Hi, this is Scott Snibbe, host of A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment. My new book, How to Train a Happy Mind, shares the accessible approach to Buddhism familiar to podcast listeners. It features a foreword by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and you can order it right now in print, ebook, or audiobook, just about anywhere you buy books. In May, I'm doing two special events in New York City, one with musician and artist Laurie Anderson, and another with DJ Spooky. Both events can also be streamed online. Go to our website at skepticspath.org for more details on the book and tour. I'm Scott Snibbe, and this is A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment. A few weeks ago, I had an extraordinary conversation with Ken Rinpoche Tashi Tsering. He shared his profound insights on a secular understanding of karma, and he talked about the importance of analytical meditation, the type of meditation we focus on with A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment. Rinpoche also had a warning about how the popularity of meditation today just might kill it. Ken Rinpoche Tashi Tsering's name is a mouthful, and so are his achievements. Rinpoche escaped Tibet as a child in the 1950s and was one of the first Tibetan monks to be wholly educated in India rather than his native Tibet. He achieved the highest level of Buddhist education, the Geshe degree, which is the Buddhist equivalent of a PhD, a 20-year course of study that begins as a boy, requiring mastery of the entire Tibetan Buddhist canon. Rinpoche is now the 91st abbot of Saramay Monastic University, where he continues a 1,000-year-old unbroken lineage of masters, originating in India's first millennium Nalanda University. For most of his adult life, Rinpoche has taught in the West as the resident teacher of the Jamyang Buddhist Center in London. Spending so much time in our culture has made Ken Rinpoche Tashi Tsering a unique teacher. He's fully qualified in the traditional Buddhist education. He has deep contemplative experience through his own meditation practice, and he understands the Western mind after spending so much of his life with us. I think you're going to enjoy this interview as much as Stephen and I enjoyed conducting it.
Ken Rinpoche Tashi Tsering, thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview today.
Thank you very much to create this opportunity. Yeah.
The audience for our podcast is typically secular people who are interested in using Buddhist meditation to bring out their best human qualities, to create the causes for a happy, meaningful life. And a number of these people have some difficulty with the elements of Buddhism that can't be verified scientifically right now, like karma and rebirth and other realms, those topics in particular. And so I was wondering if you could share your advice for Westerners who want to benefit from the Buddhist mind training techniques, but have trouble with these elements that might appear even supernatural to a Western mind?
Yes. Usually I approach this kind of situation, people who are strongly interested in some of the Buddhist teachings and techniques, such as meditation, explanation of mind training, but same time, as you said, you know, have a difficulty to understand or to accept some of the Buddhist theory, karma, future life, and so forth. And my usual approach to that levels of people is something that you are very skeptical, very, you know, not very sure. These are not initially not that important. These are just really given to the people who brought up in that kind of environment, in that kind of culture. From the Buddhist point of view, these are the process, not immediately need to understand everything. Having said that, myself, of course, you know, culturally, socially, you know, how, where I brought up, I accept future life. But do I have a total understanding of everything? I don't. You know, some of those helpful, useful Buddhist techniques, meditations, trainings, like mind trainings and so forth, you know, apply those things. Apply those things to receive the benefits in your daily lives, to benefit to yourself, then that means that will automatically benefit to your family, and that may gradually expand to the community. And so initially, the best way to approach these things is first use some of those things that you are quite happy with, that you are quite convinced with, these are working, this will work, I can understand. Use those techniques and those teachings to receive the benefit to yourself. Then over the years, or over the decades, you may get some glimpse of understanding of possibility of future life, possibility of those karmic things. And that is my usual suggestion to the people who are in that level.
And what are some of the types of mind training techniques you'd recommend for this type of student?
To understand, to apply those techniques, such as meditation, such as analysis, the investigation. First, the individuals have to have some form of understanding our mind can change, our way of viewing internal world, outside world can change. They are not static. That is quite well accepted from the Western scientists, like brain plasticity theories and so on and so forth. I think that understanding is something I usually see as a base or the foundation. No matter how difficult mindsets or difficult emotional structure or difficult viewpoint that we have, if we want to change, then to understand it is possible to change. Then also to understand a little bit what His Holiness Dalai Lama used the term saying, map of the mind or map of the consciousness. Sometimes mind is quite elusive term in the West. The map of the consciousness, map of the emotion, not just the surface, not just the very active thoughts and emotions and memories, how they function, but also try to understand a little bit in a subconscious level, more in a subtle level, how they structure, how they function. It is not just only destructive emotions, thoughts, but also constructive emotions and thoughts. So get some understanding of a map of consciousness, emotions and thought will be, again, very useful as a foundation. And in that context, I think to understand very forefront of our emotions, Western modern psychologies, neuroscience may help us. But not just Buddhism, but also ancient Indian spiritual traditions have a long histories of trying to understand our inner world, bringing these two together and try to complement to each other. That will be very useful. Then I think we may get the good base or the good foundation to apply some of those, like, for example, mindfulness meditation, to bring a sense of relaxation, sense of calm, and then also vipassana meditation to make our mind capable to really penetrate depth of the reality, reality in the sense our thoughts, emotions, and as well as when these thoughts, emotions, our perceptions interact with the outside world. Those two things, technically called shamatha, to bring the quality of focus, quality of clarity, and then on top of that, to bring the analytical qualities. These two are very useful to do some of the mind trainings, such as cultivation of deep sense of love. Because this calm focus and that join or combine with the sharp analytical will bring the deeper understanding of sense of love, sense of need of love for the others. So those are something which is useful.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. So you mentioned vipassana. I wonder if you could explain to someone who wasn't familiar with that word what vipassana means and why we would undertake vipassana, what its benefits are.
The term vipassana is sometimes, this 21st century, it is overused. But overall, comfortably I can say, although I'm not that expert in ancient Theravadin tradition, first I will talk about briefly what is vipassana meditation. To be a vipassana meditation, in that meditation, there should be a good analytical element. Whether you do it analysis during the meditation or at the beginning of the meditation, or prior to do the vipassana meditation, you have done the actual analysis on what subject you are doing vipassana meditation. Without that, it is quite difficult to claim as a vipassana meditation, but it is up to the individual. Now, coming to that which I am more familiar with is Tibetan Buddhism. So in the Tibetan Buddhism, you know, the vipassana meditation, it is called Lhakdong, Lhakpar Thongwa. It has a literal meaning, you know, seeing more or seeing further, which is special insight. There are several different terms are used in English. So that is the vipassana. As we know, Tibetan Buddhism is very much based on Nalanda masters, Indian Nalanda masters' traditions. They clearly set a sequence. For example, Kamala Shila, this great, great Indian master, clearly structured as a sequence. First, shamatha. That means first, you should cultivate that quality of stillness and the clarity. When the individual's minds have that kind of quality, then that mind gradually turn into analytical mind. Without that kind of qualities, stillness, clarity, calmness, without that kind of mental quality, it will be quite hard to have a good analytical mind. And that is first shamatha, then the vipassana. And the Tibetan Buddhism, you know, in the Vajrayana teaching is slightly different. Otherwise, that is the sequence, fixed sequence. And so therefore, when it comes to the meditation as a vipassana, then quite often the Indian great masters are divided vipassana meditation into two stages. In Tibetan, Jigdenpa Lhakdong. Jigdenpa Lhakdong means vipassana meditation. The things that you are analyzing is more like a mundane things. And then Jigdenpa Deba Lhakdong, the second one is saying, you know, super mundane vipassana meditation. That means that the subject of your meditation is not the mundane phenomena or mundane things and events. Subject of your meditation, vipassana meditation, is, you know, such as nature of impermanence, such as nature of selflessness, such as nature of emptiness. When your analytical meditation is on these topics, then the vipassana meditation is called super mundane vipassana meditation. So it is a really vast meditation. Like, for example, you know, nowadays people use saying body scanning meditation as a vipassana meditation. I think that, you know, can be fine. We can call it vipassana meditation because your mind is totally focused. Your mind is scanning or analyzing stage by stage. That is fine, called as a vipassana meditation. So the vipassana meditation is not just one meditation. It has a vast topics. It depends on what topic that you are meditating on, and the overall what you need in that meditation, you need a degree of analysis. When you have a degree of analysis, then you can call it a vipassana meditation. But, you know, it is a very loose term that I'm using, vipassana.
So the body scan type of meditation would be the mundane topic of vipassana, whereas a selflessness meditation would be the super mundane.
Even within the body scanning meditation, you can have a very vast range. Just simply your mind to be with your body, do the scanning meditation. That is simple, but you scan your body stage by stage to search, to analyze whether there is a body, some kind of intrinsic, inherent, some kind of in and of itself as a body, then you are doing more deeper Vipassana meditation.
That's wonderful. You mentioned that some of these Vipassana meditations have their roots in the Nalanda tradition, and His Holiness is very often citing those roots for Tibetan Buddhism. For people that aren't familiar with the Nalanda tradition, could you briefly just say a little bit about that tradition and how it influenced Buddhism?
Yes, that Nalanda Buddhist tradition has a very strong element of cultivation of altruism. In Sanskrit, it is called bodhicitta, which is a very, very profound meditation. It's extremely helpful and useful to ourselves and to others. Like, for example, one of the great, great Nalanda master, Nagarjuna, some of his texts has many amazing passages how to expand our caring, loving, altruism mind to vast numbers of living beings. On top of that, the Nalanda masters have this emphasis on it is taught. You must do your own work. You know, as Buddha himself stated, don't take my words as a out of reverence, but do the analysis. And Nalanda masters really apply that very strongly, very skeptically approaching to the teachings through analysis, investigation, find out the facts, find out the meaning of the teachings, then apply that in your daily lives. That is from the methodological side. And another important topic is understanding of this Buddhist teaching of selflessness, anatma, emptiness. Although selflessness as anatma is common to the Theravadin and Mahayana, but in the Nalanda Buddhist masters, their explanation, interpretation on that subject of selflessness is very vast and have a very expounded explanation. So those are some of the unique difference from Theravadin Buddhists. I'm not saying one is better than another, but you know, that just to answer to your question.
You also talked about the other type of meditation of developing concentration. And you mentioned mindfulness, which we learn about in Tibetan Buddhism. Mindfulness is a specific tool to help develop concentration. But the word mindfulness also is now the name of a very popular type of meditation that's been popularized in the West. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between the two meanings of that word, mindfulness as the tool as it's understood in Tibetan Buddhism, and mindfulness as a popular form of meditation today?
I know a little bit about how the mindfulness, the term, and the meditation is used these days in the wider community. My understanding in that context, the meaning of the mindfulness is simply to make our mind just to slow down, just in a form of slow down fashion, and to say, stay at the present. I'm not criticizing, but overall, that's what I've got. The mindfulness, in that popular sense, mindfulness meditation is more like a slow down our thinking and just to stay to the present, either on the breathing or something. But when we read some of those great Indian masters, then it is not just slowing down our thinking mind. It has a strong element of, in Tibetan, called sherab. Sherab is wisdom. It needs element of sherab in the sense thinking mind. If we very much slow down the thinking mind, it is difficult to the mindfulness. When we say the thinking mind, it is not talking about that jumping one subject to another subject, you know, one sort of event to another event, like sometimes term is used monkey mind. not in that kind of thinking mind, but a sharp, alert, fully aware of what's here, what's present. And that element is very, very important element. Otherwise, difficult to count in the Buddhist teaching called mindfulness. That mindful, tempa tang sheshin. Tempa is translated as a mindfulness. But also this another element, sheshing, introspection or alertness. When we do the mindfulness meditation, that other element, sheshin, the introspection must be there. Otherwise, mindfulness meditation won't be that kind of fresh, fully alert, and so on and so forth. So in other words, the difference nowadays that popular so-called mindfulness meditation, which commonly used, is more slow down thinking mind and to stay to the present. Buddhist, the meaning of mindfulness meditation is very much fully alert, fully aware of things, not really slow down your thinking element of the mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So the difference is the addition of that sharp alertness.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So you've spent a long stretch of time in the West, primarily as the teacher at the Jamyang Center in London. And I'm wondering how your interaction with Westerners has changed how you teach the Dharma in any way?
Yes. When I came to Jamyang, 1994, May, the people come to the classes are lay people. Lay people have many other commitments. What they need is something immediately what they can apply when they go back to their family life. So what I did is, instead of teaching one text from the beginning to the end, selected particular topic, like how to handle destructive emotions, bring that as a topic. And instead of saying, oh, this is anger, anger is defined in this, instead of that, just to bring one of the destructive emotion is anger. We all know that, hatred. How do you feel when you are angry? And to bring that more in the discussion, more in the, you know, sharing topic. Then gradually to edit what I've understood from those great Indian masters. So that is very different from traditionally where we teach here.
So you'd start more with the practical and mental challenges that people have and how to address them.
Yes, exactly. But then adding the Indian masters, Tibetan masters, how they explain, how they interpret it. It's really bringing two things together, their own experiences, you know, being angry, how they feel it, what are the methods they have used. Still remember very clearly a lady who came to that and she said, oh yeah, my therapist told me if I'm angry, I can bang my pillow. And I thought, wow, that is interesting. First time I heard that. Of course, later I've many times, banging pillow, how does it work? What's going to happen if pillow bursts and full of feathers? So I teased the lady and there are these interesting things I've learned.
And then what was the Buddhist advice you give and how to deal with anger?
Buddhist teachers, and I think this is a very universal method, individuals need to understand advantages and disadvantages. And that is a very important one. You know, what are the disadvantages of losing your temper or being angry? And on the other hand, what are the advantages having compassionate, loving, caring, and calm mind? That needs to be, at least at certain stage, needs to be understood, the benefits, advantages, and disadvantages. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult to deal with, for example, anger. A person who keeps losing his or her temper, he or she need to convince, losing my temper, there's no benefits. Those big companies who want to sell their product, why they advertise saying it is very good, it is very nice, it is very cheap, why they do that? They want to convince their customers it is good. It is cheap. It is useful. When the customers convinced that is the case, then they will go there. And also the convincing is not just saying once. Need to say it again and again and again and again. I usually say, you need to convince yourself, losing temper, even though immediately may get some sort of benefit, but in the long term, there is no positive result. You need to convince yourself. And to convince yourself, you need to think it again and again and again. When the conviction is there, then you will apply. Otherwise, people who are losing their anger is more habitual, then it's very difficult to tackle. And this is what, for example, Shantideva wrote this amazing text, Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. The first chapter, what he did, he explained the benefits of having altruistic mind, explaining how useful, how helpful having that mind. And that is the case in the many texts written by those great Indian masters, because they understand the psychology of the human mind. If we are convinced, then they will do it.
So understand the drawbacks of disturbing states of mind, understand the benefits of beneficial states of mind, and then learn the techniques to cultivate the beneficial one.
Exactly, exactly.
I listened to a talk you gave at Jamyang recently. I believe you said that the popularity of meditation in the West might kill it. I hope I got my quote right. Could you explain what you meant by that, if you don't mind?
Because mindfulness or meditation become, that term become very, very popular, then the term is used in many different ways and many different things. Eventually, when people talk about meditation or the mindfulness meditation, people will say, oh yeah, it is just junk. You know, right at the beginning, they may reject. And that's the worries me. Because they see, they heard, why I said that, I think it might be relation to this. When I was doing my writing dissertation on MA, one day I went for a walk in central London, and on Regent Street, a very, very, very posh new shop is opening. On the pavement, they put a huge, very, very attractive banner, what they are selling, but under that banner, they put a meditation. When I saw that, I was shocked. So what they're selling as a meditation? I found out inside they're selling jewelry, very, very, expensive jewelry. But what they put in down there, they put meditation. So that sort of things. Because I was shocked with that. I even took lots of photos and to keep as a record what I've seen. So that is the things. Of course, knowing meditation, knowing mindfulness meditation is very, very useful. Whether you have any particular belief system or not, it doesn't matter. If you do a mindfulness meditation in a secular way or with the religious element, no doubt it will benefit. But without knowing this and constantly hearing and seeing these sort of things, then people may reject right at the front, these are just junk. And that is my worry.
So it seems the concern is that these words may just lose their meaning and not have the rich connotations that they traditionally had.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I had a few specific questions about Buddhist topics.
Yes, yes.
So for somebody who doesn't believe in rebirth, I'm wondering how someone like that could think about the concept of karma and still, benefit from those teachings.
The teaching of karma, as you know, is not unique in Buddhism. Hinduism, Brahmanism, Jainism, they all have this concept of karma and a karmic result. Karma is the action, karmic result, the result. So therefore, it is not unique Buddhism. So now, the teaching of karma is given even before the Buddha, I think, and the Buddha embraced that concept and taught that, mainly to have ethical way of living. You know, whether we believe my present actions will catch up me in my next life or not. But we all have some experience, like my age, now 60-something, my sort of earlier lives, what I've done, what I've engaged in, my interaction with other beings have consequences to my present right here and now. For example, my activities, first of all, entering into this big monastery, having great opportunity to interact with these great teachers, the consequences or the result of those actions, I've learned many valuable things from those actions, from those activities. I remember very clearly when I and some of my friends in my generation, when we joined Sarah Monastery, we young monks, our daily activity is just to memorize. Memorize, memorize, memorize. And in the evening, go outside, and then, you know, what you have memorized, say it again and again and again, until sometimes 11:30, 12. So those activities, those actions, those karma, if we use, I feel I've benefited great. Many of those memorization that I've put effort, I worked, still I can say it without any difficulties. Don't need to think about what the action that I have done and I'm going to do, the result may going to happen sometime next life. No, I think we need to think about right here and now. And also, it is human nature. It is human nature. We all have thinking tomorrow, although tomorrow is not here. So the teaching of karma is saying to pay attention to our present action, because there will be consequences this afternoon or tomorrow, next week or next month. And that is really something which we need to understand.
That's wonderful. I really like the way you describe that. It's extremely practical. So you're saying that we can think of karma just once you reach a certain age. It sounds like you need to have a little bit of time in your life. But once you reach a certain age, you can look back and look at your actions and your thoughts and just analyze the results they had, see whether they were harmful or beneficial, and then try to cultivate the beneficial ones.
Exactly, exactly.
Ah, that's very nice. It's so simple, but I haven't heard it explained that way. Very practical. Another difficult topic for people, you know, especially secular people, is suffering.
Oh, yes.
So I'm wondering if you could talk about how could secular people think of suffering in a way that brings meaning and joy to their life rather than fear and sadness?
When we talk about suffering, particularly death and so forth, in the West, it is very sensitive topic or very scaring topic or very unpleasant topic one to avoid. And there is a sense of culture in that. But also same time, not to exaggerate. You know, sometimes when we talk about suffering in a traditional way, it's more a little bit scaring manner. You scare people. That is also not very helpful. I think when we talk about, when we share the nature of suffering, we should share with the realistic. When we talk about there's a suffering, we're not talking about gross suffering all the times. You know, gross suffering comes and goes. Of course, from the Buddhist point of view, underlying suffering like aging, possibility of sickness are all the time there. But gross suffering is not happening all the time. It happens and comes and goes. And it is the nature of the suffering. And also, same time, we need to understand, you know, whether it's gross suffering or subtle suffering and the very underlying suffering. As a human beings, we have this, what His Holiness called, marvelous, you know, brain. We have that. We have this amazing culture and history, how to solve the difficulties individually and collectively. Bring those things into background when we talking about suffering, when we are thinking about suffering, when we are contemplating about suffering. Not just the suffering, but possibility of it can be relieved, it can be cured, it can be overcome. Because I'm a human being, I have these amazing capabilities. There are many different means and methods. Look at the current situation. It is very scary about this virus. But there are amazing scientists, doctors, nurses, you know, putting their efforts to really to overcome this current situation. So when Buddha taught, as his first teaching, when he says there's a dukkha, there's a suffering, it is simply to tell the truth, not to try to avoid, not to try to put under the carpet, but to be aware of that. And when we are aware of that, then that awareness will give us the step to seek the solutions, means and methods. And those are the something useful. You know, there is a nice small booklet by His Holiness Dalai Lama's teaching on Four Noble Truths. He said, you know, if there's no solution to overcome suffering, then there's no point to think about suffering. And that is very important.
So the point of reflecting on suffering is to just come to terms with reality, not exaggerated and also not sweeping it under the carpet.
Yes.
To understand and cultivate the antidotes.
Yes.
Ken Rinpoche, thank you so much for this incredible interview. I learned a lot from talking to you, and I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of your insights. We really appreciate you granting us some of your precious time in a busy day. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Scott. And it is really a pleasure. Thank you to you as well as Stephen and all the people who are going to listen. Take care and be happy and to engage with the outside world, to make this world more peaceful and a more caring and loving environment. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us in this special episode with Ken Rinpoche Tashi Sering. This is our second episode in the interview format conceived and produced by my partner in A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment, Stephen Butler. We'd love to hear what you think about the interview format and this episode in particular. You can share your feedback on our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram page. If you have time right now to write a review for our podcast on Apple Podcasts, it helps other people discover and enjoy our unique take on meditation. To write a review, click on the link to Apple Podcasts on our webpage at skepticspath.org and then provide a quick rating or review. Thanks again for listening, and may your day be happy and meaningful. Mm-hmm.